Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. My guest is Joe Hagan. He's written a book called Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone magazine. Now, it's my belief that much of the fiction and poetry that you hear me talking about are the result of a change in the culture. The change in the culture began, say, in the mid-60s, when it became important to figure out a way to write about rock and roll and to write about movies. These were valiant forms beating at the door of the culture, and the youngest writers were trying to figure out the new sound, not just the new sound of a song, the new sound of a sentence that would make for rock and roll criticism, movie criticism, and then on beyond that, in the time between 1967, when it published its first issue, and now they published Hunter Thompson at Rolling Stone, they published Tom Wolfe, they published major critics. Tell me, you come to talk to Jan Wenner. Did you find that he knew what he had done in this regard?
Well, yeah, he was proud of having published these people. They were like, you know, jewels in his crown, really, you know, especially Hunter Thompson, whose, you know, legacy he feels deeply responsible for and connected to. He was at the center of the inflection point when the culture was shifting, as you're saying, and about to pivot to where the entire rock and roll youth culture was going to start absorbing the values and begin to look at art and music and film as an expression of their kind of new values.
Now, you're a journalist.
Yeah.
And rock and roll gave, I would say, a new valorization to journalism. Journalism was famous at the time for crusty old sorts who worked at newspapers and had worked at them forever. And suddenly, in San Francisco, 1967, a whole new look is coming to the writing that's going on in the journalism. To what extent are you the heir to that?
Myself?
Yes.
Absolutely, 100% the heir to it. I mean, I grew up, you know, as I got into journalism, Tom Wolfe was a touchstone. It was something you had to reckon with. In fact, you had to wrestle with it because you didn't want to imitate it as much as you desired to imitate it. But it was, he showed you how you could stretch and deepen and bring novelistic, you know, virtues to your writing. And God, I mean, I tried to do some of that in my own book. And I write in the afterword of the book that that Jan Wenner's legacy were these sorts of writers, Tom Wolfe, Hunter S. Thompson. I felt incredible kind of responsibility to reach for the moon.
By 1967, a lot of what we're talking about, Dylan had done some of his best records. The Beatles had done all of their best records.
That's true.
Joni Mitchell had done her three earliest records. Rolling Stone, unlike popular legend, isn't the start of this.
No.
It's the place that gives it a legitimacy and eventually a big popularity, and then turns it gradually into a commercial fact of American life that people are getting wealthy on rock and roll music.
Right.
So the book goes from instinctual creativity, a history through the 70s and 80s, to the story of the me decade, the greed decade, and now a hunger to be a billionaire.
Yeah. Or famous.
Or fame. Well, at least famous, but at best a billionaire. Now, tell me, did you become hostile, as many people have, to Rolling Stone in the course of writing about it?
It's interesting. There's more than one Rolling Stone because there's more than one decade. I read issue by issue Rolling Stone through the 1970s, and I was just deeply fascinated and kind of, it was wonderful. You know, it was being dropped into the culture in a way that was rich, and you saw what was so narcotic about and so wonderful about the freedom they were all experiencing. And it was messy. You know, it was not yet edited well is the real truth. And that was part of what was great about it, because people could experiment. And the experimentation, the feeling of like being in the middle of an ongoing experimentation in literature and journalism and rock and roll, it felt Dionysian, you know. And that, of course, over time gels into something else that's less interesting. And by the 80s, it is kind of toxic and not as interesting. I mean, there's still great journalism being done, don't get me wrong, okay? But when you come to these latter day times, it's reflecting the culture, and the culture itself is also not as appealing.
I'm going to make the assertion that the early days of Rolling Stone reflect the early days of filmmakers like Jean-Luc Godard. We're talking about the perception of a culture in fragments and an article that's going to find a way, by hook or by crook, to hold the fragments together. Right. And it gets very exciting to read a long Rolling Stone piece because in its unedited or anti-edited early days, you never knew where a piece was going to go next.
Well, that's right. And imagine if you're somebody who has not been exposed to this culture before and you pick up a copy of this in 1972, you have been dropped into just an amazingly exotic world. This is an education. This is like a window into the freedom you've only heard about, you know?
And people don't understand that there was a time when movies weren't taken seriously, when rock and roll was not taught in colleges. These were people who were trying to take these journalists, what they learned in literary criticism, and apply it to rock and roll. And it was ideal because you can analyze a Dylan song or a Beatles song the way you would analyze a poem. And they did.
Yeah, absolutely. And they, you know, these were, a lot of them were, you know, had an academic bent at first. You know, I mean, the first wave of rock criticism, you know, was John Landau. Okay, he was the first major rock critic at Rolling Stone. He was going to Brandeis studying medieval history, you know, and if you read his early stuff, it was very pedantic and sort of like pretentious, to be frank. And but who was being pretentious about the Supremes?
At some point, Jan Wenner gets a letter telling him to read Gril Marcus's book, Mystery Train.
Right.
That it's the best thing that's happened.
Yeah, Ralph Gleason wrote that letter. Ralph Gleason, the jazz critic. Yeah,
the brilliant jazz critic, yes. Who was the mentor, really.
And co-founder of Rolling Stone.
Exactly. And you see, one of the exciting things about Rolling Stone, as reported in the book I'm talking about, Sticky Fingers, by my guest Joe Hagan, is that it's not long before Gril Marcus writes for Rolling Stone and gets into a fight with Jan Wenner and doesn't write again. People leave for years at a time.
Yeah.
But Rolling Stone remains, during its good periods and its bad periods, the central fact that this is where you're going to go if you're taking pop culture, rock culture, new culture, youth culture seriously.
Well, absolutely. And I think that you can't separate that from the fact that as Rolling Stone became successful, it's an audience. And it's an audience that you can relate to, that you can speak to, and you can speak your mind to.
And let's face it, that song, Sympathy for the Devil, which begins, "Please allow me to introduce myself." That's the first thing the devil says in the novel The Master and Margarita. I mean, the rock people, however much we want to think of them as Dionysian,
yeah,
they were reading the incredible literature of the time, and Allen Ginsberg, for instance, was appearing from time to time in Rolling Stone,
oh,
or
absolutely,
being reported about or profiled.
Right.
This is what the magazine was for. It later became the profiling of the newest cars,
right,
or the biggest and most expensive stereo systems.
Right.
But at that time, the time that I'm most interested in, advertisers thought that the readers couldn't afford cars and stereo systems. They were saving their money for their dealers.
Yeah. Well, and that's, especially in the late 60s, it was all head shops and, you know, freeform radio stations and, you know, festivals were advertising, rock festivals. And but, you know, Jan Wenner, of course, wanted to change that and was looking to change it over time. But he was tracking with the culture and, you know, a great magazine editor. This is a, you know, kind of defunct kind of role in our culture now. But at the time, it was about having your finger on the pulse of what was going on. And at the outset, it was the kind of wild circus of the culture at that point that had not really been defined yet. God, you had incredible poetry was being published in Rolling Stone. Fiction was being published in Rolling Stone. An interview with Stockhausen was being published in Rolling Stone. Henry Miller.
Jonathan, you know, Cott, am I right?
Jonathan Cott, who was, yes, the real sort of like forefront.
The real deal.
Yeah, he was the intellectual kind of tip of the pencil at Rolling Stone in a lot of ways, you know, a sort of a would-be Oxford scholar.
A lot of these people come from the new journalism. Tom Wolfe certainly does. But I was very surprised, for instance, to learn, because I found one of those anthologies, the new journalism. And Charles Porter's,
yes,
was a writer doing that kind of first-person stuff. And what does he do? He leaves it. He goes home, he writes a masterpiece, True Grit.
Right.
Tell me, what are the tenets of the new journalism?
Well, the first, you know, one seems to be, you know, the strictures of the novel, the freedom of the novel could redefine how you kind of explored nonfiction and reporting, how you could make reporting and how you could enliven a scene even, or a piece of dialogue, and write it the same way, you know, Norman Mailer or, you know, name your literary hero would have done it in a novel, and some of those values. And also later with Hunter Thompson, especially the doing away with the idea that there's something objective happening here, putting in the subject, the writer, in his point of view or her point of view.
Well, it's central to what was happening. Joan Didion's first books, Slouching Toward Bethlehem, are central because she is herself there talking to the 7-year-old girl who's on acid.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and when she's asked about did she feel immoral, she answers in the recent documentary about her, "Are you kidding? That was gold."
Yes.
You don't,
right,
throw that away.
Yeah.
And so part of it is the shocking.
Yes.
Going into the center of a story at its shock point.
Yes.
You're not keeping the pulse, the finger on the pulse. We're talking about a very jumpy pulse or arrhythmia,
yes,
or tachycardia.
Yeah.
You know, and these people, as I read your book, so many of them are working so late into the night, writing so much and so crazily, they're all having heart attacks.
Yeah, right. I know. Well, there's a sense of drugs cannot be discounted as a major influence.
Cannot be discounted.
Yeah.
There's an understatement.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
Rolling Stone starts in its wild ambitions by creating a new type of person. That type of person is the fan.
Yeah.
There have been fans, certainly, for Elvis Presley, but this is a different coeducational, male and female. They're not fainting. They're being more and more conscious. And they love what they love. Jan Wenner, the big deal is becoming friends with John Lennon. And if it means Yoko Ono too, Yoko Ono too.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's sort of, these are people who become fans of intellectualizing the music they're listening to. They want it to mean as much to them as a poem means or as a novel means.
And they want something from John Lennon that is much deeper than what people had wanted from Elvis. You know, they wanted the, yes. What they wanted from Elvis was a little bit of the shock of the new and the Eros and the, you know, the, those kinds of things. But like from John Lennon, they want truth. There's a new idea that these guys have the truth, that truth can be gotten from these rock leaders, so to speak.
There's something about Rolling Stone that from the beginning was stalled outside certain barriers. So despite the desegregation marches and the consciousness of race, Rolling Stone never brought in black music as much as Ralph Gleason wanted them to.
No, I know. Well, that's one thing that I think a service of cultural observation I felt like I could bring here was to note Jan Wenner's own arc in the story, which is important here. He came out of like a socialite scene in San Francisco, and there were all these sort of well-to-do kids, well-educated from families that lived in Pacific Heights, which was the fancy part of San Francisco. These were the kids, and from Berkeley, who were going down to Haight-Ashbury and adopting this new culture, and they came from a place of privilege, and they wanted to see themselves reflected back, and that's in rock and roll in many ways was reflecting a white male culture that had existed before, but it was a new costume. And, you know, there were black artists in Rolling Stone, and they did love R&B, and John Landau, that's all he liked, the critic. But there was more of like a fetish than it was a, you know, on the same level in terms of power. And it didn't, you know, later, I found this sad, but it's true. They found doing reader surveys that the black artists on the cover of the magazine didn't sell.
And they didn't care about anything but sales, and that was the problem. Because once upon a time, what I remembered was that the great critics and magazines of the time didn't sell. So what?
Yeah.
We'll force it down your throat.
Yes.
Until if it's worth your time, we'll give it to you, give it to you, give it to you, until you see why it's worth your time.
Right.
We make the decisions.
Right. And well, that Rolling Stone did do that at the outset.
At the beginning.
But over time, the cart went before the horse, and it was advertising that was leading it.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Joe Hagen about his book, Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone Magazine. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Joe Hagen about his latest book, Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone Magazine, an intimate look at the heyday of rock and roll and the man who provided a backstage pass for readers of his magazine, Rolling Stone. Well, okay. Everyone talks about the youth and optimism of the early Rolling Stone. The youth and optimism preceded Rolling Stone. Rolling Stone looked for a way to report that optimism and in many ways succeeded and then fell into the pit that all optimism falls into, that it gets defeated by materialism. Idealism, whether it's in Don Quixote, whether it's in Candide, idealism leads to materialism, and materialism leads to the death of whatever you once adored. And so we're reading a book here in your book that's about the death of ideals. Would you agree?
There's definitely an arc to the story. The needs of capitalism had cut two ways. On the one hand, it made the magazine stay alive, and it kept it going for many years, and it continued almost like a narrative that you could follow, starting with the 60s, and it kept the 60s alive. It kept some of it alive in it, but it eventually began to focus on celebrity. And celebrity, you know, we talked a minute ago about being fans of John Lennon and the truth that he could bring you. But eventually what you wanted was something different than just truth. It was like titillation. It could be just the act of confession, right? That this was, you know, the tabloid values began to seep into it, and because it sold. And over time, one replaces the other.
The story of Rolling Stone goes from there to, in the last pages of your book, people comparing Jan Wenner, the editor who is the narrator, essentially the narrative focus of Sticky Fingers, they're comparing Jan Wenner with Donald Trump.
Right.
This is a huge arc. This isn't just the gradual arc of the story. This is the story of our times. Do you think that Jan Wenner really is an iconic figure of that sort? I know he thinks so.
Yeah. Well, what I say in the book is that he helped pioneer some of the celebrity culture that we are living in today. And over time, you know, that celebrity culture began to take over everything until, catalyzed by the internet, you've got a man who actually emerges from that celebrity culture and knocks down the last halls of power. You know, we talk about the me decade of the 70s, and in the book I say, which was followed by another me decade and another me decade until you have President Me, you know, the ultimate narcissist, the ultimate kind of reflection of our self-involved celebrity culture.
Well, every new idea is an invitation to a new style. And the style of this book, which is very interesting, I would say that it's written not as an LP, it's not Sgt. Pepper, it's written as a collection of singles. The singles are in the chapter title, so a chapter about the emergence of sexuality in the 60s has the title, Are You Experienced? The following chapter is California Dreamin', Like a Rolling Stone, Born to Run, Sympathy for the Devil. We're listening to the singles that are the iconic forces of their time, and we're coming to understand something that I think is very interesting about this book, that we are able to summarize what we've lived through in brisk and pithy phrases. Mm. And that, I think, is the result of joining journalism with advertising.
Yeah. That's interesting. Lots of books have been written about rock and roll culture from the vantage of its default a virtuous thing, that the 60s and everything that was produced out of them and the musical renaissance that washed over for the next many decades, you know, you could always look back on it as a touchstone of like hope and optimism because it was what you saw as your essential the values that we're talking about of literature and truth and beauty. But now, look where we have arrived. And I had to kind of look back in a completely different way. And his story allowed me to do that, to be truthful. You know, allowed me to look at how did we get from John Lennon on the cover of Rolling Stone to Donald Trump? How did that happen? And in a way, exactly to what you're saying, I was able to kind of almost like a collection of songs, but in a collection of you know, moments that Jan was a part of, Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone, to watch that transformation.
It's said that Jan Wenner is not happy with this book.
Right.
Is he right not to be happy with it, given who he is?
No. I think that he should or will, I think over time he will, come to see that a true story about him is going to be the most powerful legacy for him. You know, I would think about the Steve Jobs book of 4 years ago. Not a very appealing person, Steve Jobs, you know. But that book showed you his impact on the culture. And if I had written a book that Jan Wenner had wanted me to write, it would have been a rose-colored book that would have been disconnected from the present. It would have felt like you had gone into a time machine to, you know, be told how wondrous and great everything was. And it would have felt disconnected from this moment, which would have been a failure of journalism, a failure of storytelling. And the truth is, I knew going into this that that the opportunity here was to tell a story of our culture and what happened to it.
This is a book that has an unhappy ending. It's very hard for writers, even still, to learn to have the courage to follow the unhappy ending. We want a rescue. We're still begging for a rescue. Make America great again, please.
Yeah.
But it's very hard to look anything in the eye.
And I think, imagine Jan Wenner at the 50-year mark of his career, which is ending now. He's selling Rolling Stone. It's hard for him to read a 540-page book about himself that ends unhappily. And for him to, see himself in context, which that would be hard for anybody.
I've been talking with Joe Hagan, author of Sticky Fingers, The Life and Times of Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone magazine, published by Knopf. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Sticky Fingers at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. Special thanks to Michelle Escobar. The technical director is Mario Diaz. And thanks to my assistant, Sean Sullivan. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.